Good afternoon and welcome to the April meeting of the Mid-Coast Forum on Foreign Relations, coming to you today from Point Lookout on the coast of Maine, the coast of sunny Maine, and a particularly warm welcome to our public radio audience. My name is Mac DeFord. I'm the head of the forum, which since 1983, we're celebrating our 30th anniversary this year. The forum has been meeting monthly to hear an invited expert from the world of the foreign service, journalism, or academia talk about critical foreign policy issues facing the United States and answer questions from our members and guests, many of whom are experts in their own right. Details about past and upcoming programs are available on our website at midcoastforum.org. Today, we're delighted to introduce Gregory Johnson, whose topic is The Last Refuge, Yemen, Al-Qaeda, and America's War in Arabia. Gregory's a former Fulbright Fellow in the Yemen. He was also, I think, a Fulbright Fellow in Cairo at one point. He's currently a doctorate candidate in Near Eastern Studies at Princeton. He's written for a variety of publications on the Yemen, including, among others, the Foreign Policy, the American Interest, the Independent, the Boston Globe, and the National. He's a co-founder of Waq al-Waq Islam, an insurgency in Yemen. That's a blog. In 2009, he was a member of USAID's conflict assessment team for Yemen. His latest book, The Last Refuge, Yemen, Al-Qaeda, and America's War in Arabia, came out this past November, and he's going to talk about his thesis today. He's going to talk about Yemen. Gregory, delighted to have you.
Thanks a lot, Mark. Thanks. Thanks to everyone for coming out. It's a real treat for me to be here. I'm very grateful to the Mid-Coast Forum on Foreign Affairs, as well as to Mac for that kind introduction, Tom and Sally and Sarah, and everyone here has been so welcoming on my first trip up to Maine, and I hope it won't be my last. It's such a great and wonderful place. What I wanted to talk about today, right before lunch, is drones and Al-Qaeda and Yemen, and what exactly the U.S. is doing and what the U.S. counterterrorism strategy has been. It's now been more than a decade since September 11th. We're now into our second presidential administration. We've had Republicans in office. Now we have Democrats in office. So what is it that the U.S. is doing when it comes to counterterrorism? What is it that the U.S. is doing in places like Yemen? And is it working? That's what I'm going to talk about here today. And what I wanted to do is sort of divide this into a couple of different parts. So in the beginning, I'll sort of lay out what it is that the U.S. is doing broadly, particularly with drones. And then in the second half of the talk, I'll look at how it is this is actually working on the ground in a place like Yemen. This is a story that I lay out in the book. I'm supposed to promote the book. There are copies for sale in the back. I think if you like what you hear, hopefully you can order some online or go to the bookstore as well. Drones are something that we've all become accustomed to over the past few years. We've heard a great deal about them. Let's be clear. Drones are an amazing piece of technology, and drones are here to stay. That technology is not going to be put back in the bottle, despite the protests that we see from different organizations, despite filibusters on the Senate floor. Drones and the technology that they bring are here to stay. But one of the things, and I think this is a real problem, and what I would call a failure of foresight from both the Bush administration as well as the Obama administration, has been that both the Republicans and Democrats have failed to put in place a legal, an ethical, and a policy framework for the use of drones when it comes to utilizing them abroad. In fact, what we heard during these last presidential elections was that President Obama and his team were scrambling to put in place some sort of a playbook for the use of drones for the next administration, because the Obama administration was worried that if for some reason they were to lose, that the next administration, a potential Romney administration, wouldn't be as trustworthy as, of course, they were. And so it's only when the Obama administration was up against potentially losing the presidency that there was this real urgency to put in place some sort of a playbook that would limit the use or at least regulate the use of drones. This is becoming more and more, I think, an issue, particularly as other countries get drone technology. The U.S. is right now in a very difficult position if China or Russia were to start using these drones and were to use them to kill what China and Russia label terrorists, just like the U.S. uses them against what the United States labels terrorists. Where does that leave the U.S. diplomatically? I think that's an important question to think about, because drones can be an effective weapon if they're used judiciously, if they're used sparingly, or they can be a weapon that does more harm than good. And I think it's about how it is that we use drones, how it is that the United States utilizes them abroad. We're constantly told that drones are, in the words of the Obama administration and their spokespeople, drones are legal, they're ethical, and they're wise. There's been a lot of debate about the legality of drones, when it is that they can be used, how it is that they can be used. There's also a lot of discussion about the ethics of drones. What does it mean for someone to kill someone when they themselves are not at risk? Now, I'm not a lawyer, and I'm not a philosopher, but I am someone who spent the last 10 years going back and forth to Yemen, interviewing members of Al-Qaeda, talking with these individuals, spending time with the tribes, living in Yemen, and I've written a book about that. And so I want to talk about the last part of that, the wisdom of drones and the effectiveness of drones. The drone technology and drones themselves are, in my mind, they're a very seductive weapon. It's very easy to use, and I think there's this idea almost that they can be some sort of a magic missile solution to a very complex, a very difficult, and a very long-standing problem. You can easily imagine people at the Pentagon who have a list, a kill list, as we often read about in the New York Times or the Washington Post, and they see this list of names of people who want to do America harm, who want to carry out attacks against America. It's very easy to then put them on the list, to use a drone when you have a spot, when you spot them in a place like Yemen or in Pakistan or in Somalia or even in Libya, to carry out a drone strike. But is that necessarily the best way to go about it? There's a belief, I believe, in Washington that drones are almost a cost-free weapon, that drones don't put American lives at stake. I'm not so sure that that's true. I think that just because the risk to American lives from drones is not immediate or apparent, that doesn't mean that the risk is not there. We're all familiar now with the term blowback. We're aware of what happened in Afghanistan in the 1980s, the U.S. supporting through Pakistani intelligence services the various mujahideen factions that were fighting the Soviets. Of course, everybody forgot about Afghanistan in the 1990s, except for the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, and we know what came out of Afghanistan in the 1990s. There is blowback, and the U.S. tends to think in very short-term strategy, I think. And that becomes a problem when you're dealing with places like Yemen and Pakistan, where memories of these people go on for quite some time, and where people remember when missiles rain down from the skies, hit their cars, kill their brothers, kill their tribesmen, kill their fathers. And that's something that I really want to address today. Because one of the things that you hear, and again, you hear this from both Republican administrations and you hear it from Democratic administrations. You hear, in fact, there was an article in the LA Times just this morning that says Al-Qaeda is shattered, that the U.S. is winning this war. And one of the ways, in fact, the only way that the U.S. judges this is the number of people killed. So the U.S. says, well, we're killing more Al-Qaeda members than ever before. We have this list of names and we continue to cross these people off. I'm not sure if in a war like the one that we're in today, if body bags are really a very good barometer for success. If the U.S. is actually creating more terrorists than it's killing, then are we actually solving the problem? Did the death of Osama bin Laden mean the death of Al-Qaeda? On September 11th, 2001, Al-Qaeda existed in Afghanistan and a few other countries, but very small, very limited. Now, there's an Al-Qaeda organization in Yemen. We hear about al-Qaeda in Iraq making a comeback. We hear about al-Qaeda in Syria. There's al-Qaeda in Mali, in Libya. So if the strategy and the approach that the U.S. has utilized over the past decade is really working, as both Republican and Democratic administrations claim it's working, then why do we continue to see al-Qaeda grow? Why do we see more and more al-Qaeda members? Why do we see al-Qaeda popping up in these various places? If we're being so successful, shouldn't we see less al-Qaeda and not more? This is a question that your own senator, Senator Collins, asked of John Brennan in his Senate hearing during his nomination hearing to be CIA director. And I think it's a very good question. And it's one I think that needs to be followed up. If what the U.S. is doing is accurate, if what the U.S. is doing is right, why do we see al-Qaeda growing in these different places? One of the things I think it's important to remember about drones and drone technology is that drones are dependent. Drones are very accurate. We always hear that drones are incredibly accurate. In fact, again, the Obama administration uses the term surgical. This is a word that gets us to think about, well, this is a weapon that we can utilize. We have an image of a car driving down a desert road in Yemen. This is a weapon that we can put in the sky. We can take out that car, kill the bad guys, kill no one else. It's very surgical. It's very clean. But there's a but, right? And this is that drones are very dependent upon human intelligence on the ground. And so, yeah, you can have a very accurate weapon system, right? You can have a drone that can pick out the car, pick out the house, only destroy that particular car, only destroy that particular house. But if the bad guys aren't in that car, or if the bad guys aren't in that house, if there's a bunch of women or children, or if there's civilians, or if you don't actually know who's in the car, then you have a real problem. The drones can be as accurate as we believe them to be, but they don't actually do much good if we kill the wrong people. And that depends on human intelligence on the ground. And I think this is what we've seen over the past decade, is that the CIA has moved away from its more traditional role of gathering and analyzing and really producing intelligence. And now the CIA has moved much more into a paramilitary organization. So we find the CIA that's operating these drones. And at the same time that the CIA has made this shift from an intelligence organization to more of a paramilitary organization, we see organizations within the Department of Defense, such as JSOC, which is Joint Special Operations Command. We see them moving from military organizations to more of intelligence gathering organizations. So now there's a lot of crossover and there's a lot of redundancy between these different bureaucracies. You have JSOC, which now detains individuals. They interrogate individuals. They have their own intelligence gathering organizations. This means that in a place like Yemen, what you have taking place is that there's actually two parallel drone programs going on. The CIA has a drone program with its own kill list. Joint Special Operations Command has its own drone program with its own kill list. Sometimes the names overlap, sometimes they don't. They both operate by different sets of rules, and it's not always clear who's carrying out what particular strike when and why it is that they're carrying out these strikes. There have been 4 U.S. citizens that have been killed in drone strikes. All 4 of them have been killed in Yemen. There was one who was killed in November 2002, Kamal Darwish. There was 2 who were killed in September 2011. One was Anwar al-Awlaki, the American-born cleric who we've heard a great deal about. Samar Khan, who's an American citizen. And then 2 weeks later, there was a 4th individual, Abdurrahman al-Awlaki, who was Anwar al-Awlaki's son, who had run away from home in an effort to seek out his father in the mountains of southern Yemen. This is a story I tell in the book. The reason I bring these up, and it's not just because of their citizenship, it's because only one of those 4 was targeted. Only Anwar al-Awlaki was actually on a U.S. kill list. The other 3, Kamal Darwish, Samar Khan, Abdurrahman al-Awlaki, were not on a kill list, but they're still dead. And I think that's something to remember. So this is, I've sort of given a little bit of an overview of drones, how it is that they're used. Now I want to look at Yemen in this second half and find out if what it is that we're doing, what's being done in the name of the American people abroad, is actually working, if it's actually having an impact. I think we all remember Christmas Day 2009. This is when Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, the group that's headquartered in Yemen, they put a young Nigerian man on a plane from Amsterdam bound for Detroit with a specially made bomb that was sewn into his underwear. And he came very close, in fact, incredibly close, to bringing down the Northwest airliner over Detroit that day. Thankfully for all of us in this room, for everyone in the United States, he failed. But he failed not because of the U.S. counterterrorism system that has been put in place since September 11th. He failed simply because the bomb didn't ignite. So he managed to make it through all the layers of security that the U.S. had put in place from September 11, 2011 to December 25, 2009. And now, as we've seen since then, we have even more layers of security. So this is why we now stand in the little booth to get these little x-ray pictures of us taken. On that day, there were about 200 or 300 members of Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula in Yemen. 200 or 300 individuals, 200 or 300 fighters. These are estimates that come from both the U.S. government and the Yemeni government. Again, I've been going to Yemen for a decade. I've been studying this group. I wrote the book about this group. I think these numbers are pretty accurate. From December 2009 to today, more than 3 years, the U.S. has been carrying out an active bombing campaign in Yemen. We've seen the number of fighters in Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula grow in 3 years from 200 or 300 to 1,000, or at least in the estimates of the State Department, a few thousand fighters. So there's been 3 years of bombing campaigns, and instead of seeing Al-Qaeda decrease, we've actually seen Al-Qaeda increase. In fact, they've more than tripled, which is an incredibly rapid amount of growth in a remarkably short amount of time. What we hear from the Obama administration is that the drone strategy, that the drone tactics, are disrupting, dismantling, and defeating Al-Qaeda. I think when we look at the results on the ground in a place like Yemen, we see that instead of disrupting, dismantling, and defeating, what's taking place is that the drones and the civilian casualties are actually exacerbating the threat and expanding the problem. And again, it's not because of people in Yemen don't march in the street when a top Al-Qaeda leader is killed. They get upset when women and children are killed, or when men are killed, or when tribesmen are killed, or when people who aren't involved in Al-Qaeda are killed. There are two types of strikes that are being used in Yemen. There's what's known as a high-value target strike. This is when the U.S. has a particular piece of intelligence about an individual and they carry out an attack on a car or on a house. So, for instance, in September of 2011, this was the strike that was used against Anwar al-Awlaki. The U.S. knew that Anwar al-Awlaki was at a particular location. They scrambled a drone from a base in Saudi Arabia, and they fired a missile that eventually killed him. But a high-value target strike does not mean that the U.S. knows everyone who's in the car or everyone who's in the house, but they know that there's one particular individual there. There's also another type of strike that's being used by the U.S. This is called a signature strike. Some people in the CIA refer to this as crowd killing, which should give you some idea of exactly what it is that's being done here. This is when the U.S. doesn't necessarily know the identities of the people that it's firing at, but the U.S. has decided, based on what analysts within the CIA call patterns of life, that these individuals are most likely terrorists or most likely members of Al-Qaeda. What that means in a place like Yemen is that these people might go to a house that the U.S. believes is a house that that Al-Qaeda uses as a safe house, or they might be driving in a car that the U.S. knows that people of Al-Qaeda are driving with. But this is a problem in Yemen, because just because you have a beard and just because you carry a gun and just because you talk about Islamic law does not make you a member of Al-Qaeda. In fact, there are plenty of stories of members of Al-Qaeda in Yemen stopping on the road with one of their little white pickups. And again, in Afghanistan, Al-Qaeda was a group of Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan was a group of Arabs in a non-Arab country. So it's a little bit easier to tell them apart. Whereas in Yemen, you have primarily a group of Yemenis in Yemen. So it's very difficult to tell who's a member of Al-Qaeda and who's not a member of Al-Qaeda. So you have a guy with a beard who stops along the side of the road, and you're a Yemeni, you're waiting on the side of the road for somebody to come along and pick you up. Very common way of getting around in Yemen. You get in the car with these guys who are Yemenis. They speak Arabic just like you speak Arabic. They look the same as you. You don't know they're members of Al-Qaeda. You're riding, and then the car blows up. There's a drone strike, which has happened. It happened earlier this year. Three guys who were riding with two guys that the U.S. figured were Al-Qaeda members got in the car with them. 15 minutes later, the car was hit by a drone strike and killed all of them. So there's two Al-Qaeda guys that are killed, but there's also three Yemeni tribesmen. And now you have an entire tribe that's upset because they don't understand why their tribesmen were killed. This goes back to the idea of human intelligence on the ground. I think the problem that the U.S. is running into in Yemen is that it's expanded the circle of who it is that it's targeting. And again, identities are very important, right? All of us have different identities. So when you're in Yemen, when you're a member of Al-Qaeda, you're often a member of a tribe as well. So you might play up your tribal identity at a particular time. You might play down your Al-Qaeda identity, or vice versa. So just because you're someone who is a member of Al-Qaeda does not mean that you're always going around sort of on official Al-Qaeda business, right? There are some Mainers in the room, I hope, which third generation, I guess, is what it needs to be. You don't always play up that portion of your identity. Sometimes you play up a different portion. And this happens in Yemen as well. The difficulty is that the U.S. is trying to ascertain, is trying to make these decisions from Washington. So the view from Washington is often much different from the view from the ground in Yemen. In fact, let me tell you a little story, I think, which gets at this point, and hopefully we'll bring it home. The last time I was in Yemen was a few months ago. It was in September and October of 2012. And when I was there, there was a court case in which two particular members, two Yemenis, were sentenced to death for being members of Al-Qaeda. And they were members of Al-Qaeda. So the court has sentenced them to death. So in the morning, the court sentences these two guys to death. In the evening, the tribe of which these guys are members of attacks an electricity station and plunges the entire capital into darkness. So what happens is in the morning, they're convicted for being members of Al-Qaeda. In the evening, they're defended as being members of a tribe. So they hold these two identities simultaneously. The problem is casualties, identity, and how it is that the U.S. counts these casualties. We know from great reporting in places like the New York Times, there's a report about a year ago by Scott Shane and Joe Becker in the New York Times, which said that the U.S., the Obama administration, counts all identified males that are killed as a result of these drone strikes as militants, all military-age males, so that is anyone over the age of 16, basically, as a militant, unless posthumously they're identified as they're cleared, essentially. So instead of, the burden of proof is reversed in this case. But that's the view from Washington. So you carry out a strike. In fact, there was a strike in December of 2009 in which the U.S. launched a strike against what it believed to be a terrorist training camp in Abyan, in southern Yemen. It turns out the U.S. fired several missiles into this, killed 55 people. Turns out that instead of being an Al-Qaeda training camp, it was a Bedouin encampment in which a few Al-Qaeda members were taking refuge, which, again, happens quite frequently. So you have cruise missiles, you have missiles that are raining down on essentially little wicker huts and little huts with tarps. All these people are killed, but because most of them are males, the U.S. doesn't count any of them as civilian casualties. It counts them as militants. But, of course, the individuals in Yemen aren't seen as militants. People know them. They know their family. They're from their tribes. And so while Washington says, well, they're militants, people in Yemen says, no, they're not militants. They're tribesmen. They're civilians. And this is the disconnect that we have. And now you see that while Washington is carrying out these attacks, it's very easy that the more attacks happen, the more individuals are being driven into the arms of Al-Qaeda, which I think goes a long way to explaining why a group like Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula has grown so strong so fast. There are a couple of other points I want to make, and one of the more important ones is this. I've traveled a lot back and forth between Washington and between Yemen to various places, And one of the things when you start to talk about counterterrorism, when you start to talk about strategy, when you sit down and you talk with people either in Yemen or in Washington or in Maine or in Princeton or wherever you happen to be, there's a big disconnect in how it is that these things are talked about in the U.S. and how it is that these things are talked about abroad. In the U.S., there's an unspoken, but I think very real assumption that this war, the war against Al-Qaeda, is one that the U.S. can win on its own. I don't think that's true. I think that this, the only way that a group like Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula can be decisively defeated is if the tribes and the clerics in Yemen stand up and take the fight to Al-Qaeda. I think that's the only way. They're the only individuals, they're the only people with the standing in society, with the gravitas to really do this. So why isn't this happening? Why aren't the Yemeni tribes and Yemeni clerics standing up and taking this fight to Al-Qaeda? We've seen a little bit of this. Let me tell you another story. This happened in 2012. In the far east of Yemen is this place called Hadramaut. In Arabic, the name translates roughly into death has come. So you can imagine what the terrain is like. It's very barren. When you see it from the sky, it's just this dusty brown. There's a little ribbon of green that runs through the middle of it. That's Hadramaut. There was a cleric, Yemeni cleric by the name of Ahmed Jaber. He stood up in the mosque every Friday and did exactly what it is that I suggested is needed to be done. He said, Al-Qaeda is carrying out crimes in the name of Islam. These guys are not true Muslims. Yemen is not Iraq. Yemen is not Afghanistan. Yemen is not a legitimate theater of jihad. These people have no place. They should not be carrying out suicide bombings. And when they do, no one should mistake what it is that they're doing with something that's sanctioned by Islam. He's doing exactly what it is that I suggested is necessary to defeat Al-Qaeda. In fact, he was doing such a good job of this. He was making so many inroads, Al-Qaeda saw its recruiting in this village really dry up. And so Al-Qaeda, because the guys are Yemenis, and because this is in Yemen, they got in touch with the cleric and they said, look, we'd like to have a conversation with you. They wanted him basically to tone his rhetoric down because they saw that he was making inroads into their recruiting. What he was saying was having repercussions. So he's a little worried because they're Al-Qaeda and he's not, but he agrees and he goes and they have a meeting. There's five of them, three Al-Qaeda guys, him and a friend who's a policeman that he brought for protection. Now, the U.S. knows that this meeting is taking place. It doesn't have all the information, but it knows that the three Al-Qaeda guys are there. So someone sees the three Al-Qaeda guys there. They're on a list. So the U.S. takes a shot, fires a missile from a drone into this meeting. And the cleric who's been railing against Al-Qaeda is killed by a U.S. missile when he's meeting with Al-Qaeda. So it's hard to say, is this a strike that did more harm or did it do more good? It certainly killed Al-Qaeda members, killed three members of Al-Qaeda, but it also killed a guy who had been railing against Al-Qaeda. And one of the things that we've seen since in Yemen is that there haven't been a whole lot of clerics who are willing to stand up and take the fight to Al-Qaeda. There's another thing that's happening. Over the past, the U.S. continually tells us, at least people like John Brennan, who's now the director of the CIA, before that was the special advisor to President Obama on counterterrorism, continually says that the U.S. isn't going after all the Al-Qaeda members. It isn't going after the foot soldiers. It isn't going after the low-level individuals. It's only going after the top guys, the guys who are plotting and planning against the United States. So it's going after, in Yemen, about 12 or 15 guys. The problem is that since the beginning of 2012, again, not since 2009, just since the beginning of 2012, the U.S. has carried out, by my account, anywhere from 40 to 60 strikes. So that's 40 to 60 strikes in an attempt to kill 12 to 15 individuals. So something doesn't add up here, right? So either the drone strikes aren't as accurate as we're continually being told that they are, the intelligence that we have that's leading to the drone strike isn't as good as we believe it is, or the U.S. is doing something entirely different from what it suggests. Because while most of the 12 or 15 individuals that the U.S. is going after haven't been killed, someone is certainly dying in those strikes. When you fire a missile into Yemen, you kill people. And who it is that you're killing is incredibly important. If you kill a member of Al-Qaeda, you tend not to see more people joining the ranks of Al-Qaeda. There's a belief that they made their decision, they paid the price. When you kill a tribesman, when you kill somebody's son, when you kill somebody's father, and they don't believe that they're Al-Qaeda, you start to see more and more people joining the ranks of Al-Qaeda. And this is why we've seen Al-Qaeda grow from 200 or 300 to now 1,000 to a few thousand, in the words of the State Department. Let me tell you one more story very quickly as I sort of come to an end. The U.S. often says that it's a decision to capture or kill these people. And in fact, we've seen this played out. The Bush administration captured a lot of people, and it put a lot of them in Guantanamo Bay. That became a real problem. The Obama administration hasn't captured very many people, but it's killed a lot of people. And in many ways, and in fact, one of the really, almost paradoxically, horrible things about the past decade is that it's become much easier, in fact, much more convenient, to kill people than it is to capture them. On the night that President Obama won re-election, November 6, 2012, that evening there was a drone strike in Yemen. It was a drone strike that killed an individual by the name of Adnan al-Qadi. Now, Adnan al-Qadi was related to the former president. He was a member of his tribe. Adnan al-Qadi was a general in the Yemeni military. Adnan al-Qadi had once been arrested for supporting al-Qaeda, but Adnan al-Qadi was free, and Adnan al-Qadi had also been utilized by the Yemeni government to negotiate with al-Qaeda. So this strike on November 2012 took place about 30 miles from the capital of Sana'a. So it's an area that the Yemeni government controls. They have complete control. This guy wasn't hiding. He was just outside of his home. Everyone knew where it is that he lived. So why was he killed and not captured? In fact, this is a question that Senator McCain posed to nominee Brennan before he was confirmed as CIA director. And Senator McCain asked, and I think very rightly, why is it that the U.S. chose to kill this individual? You'll get no intelligence from a dead man, obviously. Why is it that the U.S. chose to kill this man instead of capturing him? He could have easily been captured. He's been captured before. Why isn't he captured now? And I think the very troubling answer to that is it's simply become easier to kill than it has been to capture. It's become easier to do away with these people through drones, which the belief is, again, that there's no immediate, no apparent risk to American lives. You don't have to put anybody on the ground. But what happens when we make mistakes? And what are the long-term implications of those mistakes? Now, let me just say a couple of things in closing. I think absent, hopefully this doesn't happen, absent any sort of a major terrorist attack, the Obama administration or any Republican administration isn't going to rethink their approach to a place like Yemen. But I think a couple of tweaks could really go a long way toward defeating al-Qaeda. I think that first the U.S. has to take signature strikes, these crowd-killing strikes, off the table. They're not efficient. They lead to more civilian casualties, which in turn increases the ranks and the numbers of al-Qaeda. It creates more fighters than it kills. And the U.S. has to use high-value targeted strikes, and only high-value targeted strikes, but it has to use them much more judiciously, much more sparingly than it has previously. The fewer strikes, the more accurate the strikes, the more al-Qaeda members are killed, the more civilian casualties are minimized. And if you do this, if you remove signature strikes, only use high-value targeted strikes, only use high-value targeted strikes in a judicious and sparing manner, you also limit the number of strikes within a country, which then opens up space for Yemeni clerics like Ahmed Jaber, Yemeni tribesmen, to take the fight to al-Qaeda. The U.S. can do a lot of good in a place like Yemen, but it can also do a lot of bad. And I think that's something, these are questions that we'll all be wrestling with for the foreseeable future, because unfortunately I don't think this threat of terrorism is going to go away. So that's my rather depressing conclusion. Thank you very much.
I think it was depressing, but it was incredibly thought-provoking, and we really appreciate it. So we got a number of questions. let me see. Here's the first one. In the book, you tell of a strong al-Qaeda resurgence in Yemen post-Saleh. Saudi Arabia seems slow to respond to this through most of 2012. Don't the Saudis have the most to lose? Why aren't the Saudis more proactive at this point?
Right. That's a good question, and whoever asked, I really appreciate you reading the book, because the book is much more than my comments today. The book is a story. It's a story about how al-Qaeda came to be in Yemen, how initially they were defeated, and then how they resurrected themselves. And the Saudis are really a key part of that resurrection, because the deputy commander of al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula today in Yemen is a guy who the U.S. once had in custody. He's a Saudi. The U.S. had him in Guantanamo Bay for several years. They released him to Saudi Arabia. He went through a rehabilitation program in Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia released him. One of the first things he did was head across the border and rejoin al-Qaeda in Yemen. And now a guy that the U.S. once had in jail is now working to kill Americans one more time. Saudis are very, very important in counterterrorism. And in fact, a lot of the breaks that the U.S. has got, if you'll remember the parcel bomb plot in 2010, this is something where Mohammed bin Naif, who's essentially the head of intelligence in Saudi Arabia, called his very good friend John Brennan. John Brennan and Mohammed bin Naif have a relationship that goes back quite some time from when Brennan was station chief for the CIA in Riyadh, and called John Brennan and tipped him off to this. If we'll remember, in 2012, early in the spring, we started to hear a lot of stories about an underwear bomb 2.0. This was an underwear bomb that even could get past the latest in U.S. technology. That was tipped off from a guy working, a spy within the ranks of al-Qaeda, working for the Saudis and working for the Americans. There is, however, a downside to this. So the Saudis and the U.S. have cooperated quite closely on intelligence when it comes to al-Qaeda, particularly al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. But the Saudis and the U.S. don't always see eye to eye on what the long-term future should be. In fact, we saw this during the Arab Spring in 2011. What happened is the U.S., which was sort of leading the transition in Yemen, really helping it to give it some shape using the political power that the U.S. had, outsourced this to Saudi Arabia because Saudi Arabia knew Yemen better. It made more sense. Saudi Arabia was closer. All of these things that you can think of. But then that gave us the rather interesting perspective of having an entrenched monarchy in Saudi Arabia leading the democratic transition for a republic like Yemen. So what it is that Saudi wants in Yemen and what it is that the U.S. want in Yemen are often in the long term, they're not quite the same thing. So there is a cost to really trusting the Saudis implicitly when it comes to counterterrorism, in that what it is that Saudi wants to see long-term in Yemen might actually take place over what it is that would be best for U.S. long-term interests.
Okay, here's one that sort of relates to what you were talking about at the end, and that is, could you expand, what do you suggest to enhance the United States on-the-ground intelligence in Yemen in order to reduce civilian losses and get the tribes to support what we're doing?
Right. That's a very, very good question. And in fact, one of the key questions and one I've thought a lot about. There was an interview with an al-Qaeda leader a few weeks ago. It was an interview published in an Arabic paper. And he was talking to a journalist I know well, a journalist who's quite close with al-Qaeda. And the journalist asked him, the Yemeni journalist asked him, what's the biggest single danger to al-Qaeda today? And the guy said, without hesitation, he said, spies. Spies within our ranks. Because these are the people that put the little electronic tracking chips into a car so the U.S. knows which drone to fire at. These are the people who identify and mark these off. And in fact, I agree with him. I think spies are absolutely the most dangerous thing to al-Qaeda today. And so for the U.S. to work with these, the U.S. to work with Yemeni intelligence, with Saudi intelligence, there are different things that all three countries bring to the table. Saudi brings a lot of knowledge of the country and a lot of money. The U.S. brings a lot of political power. Yemen brings an intimacy with what's happening on the ground there. I think if the three countries were able to work together, they could go a long way towards really destroying and interrupting what it is that al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula is trying to do through spies on the ground and then smarter, more judicious drone strikes. But again, there's a bit of a downside to this. The way that it is in the U.S., if you'll remember just a couple of minutes ago, I referenced the April 2012, the Underwear Bomb 2.0. This was something that neither the Saudis, the spy, was working with MI6 as well, British intelligence. Neither the Saudis or the Brits wanted the spy's identity to be known, because once it was known, he was sort of burned. The U.S. leaked the information. Now the spy is burned. And in a similar story, there were some spies who were uncovered, a couple of Yemenis, a couple of Saudis, who were, again, working with Saudi intelligence. They had been placing electronic tracking chips in cars, and then the U.S., working with Saudi intelligence, would fire drones at these cars. One of the drone strikes killed 8 guys. One of these guys had a young son, a young boy, about 6 years old, by the name of Salim. When al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula found the 3 spies, they did essentially what medieval kingdoms did. They took the 3 spies to different portions of the territory that they controlled, and they executed them all. One of the executions, they brought a big crowd down to the town square, in fact, to a basketball court, and crucified the spy. They hung him up on a light post and crucified him to death. And they brought Salim, the little boy, 6-year-old boy. You can see the picture. He has like hair curling around his ears. He has little baby teeth in his mouth. He's an adorable boy. This little boy points up at the man on the cross, and he says, "There's the traitor who killed my father." And it's that's a real worry for me, is that the environment that gave birth to the current generation of leaders within al-Qaeda, that's an environment from the late 1990s. The environment today that's shaping the worldview of young boys like Salim is much, much more radical than we saw in the late 1990s. So what does this mean? Does this mean that the seeds of future generations of terrorists are being sown today?
Okay, here are two related questions. And the first one is the growth of al-Qaeda in the Yemen, at least, related to the growth of failed states rather than the increased use of drones? And the related question is Yemen viable, or could it be? Ever, or is it inherently a failed state?
Right. Both of those are good questions. And I should be clear. I don't think drones are the only reason that al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula is growing. But I think that drones, and more specifically, not the drone technology, but the civilian casualties as a result of drone strikes, are the key reason that al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula is growing. Not the only reason, but a key reason. Certainly, al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, this group in Yemen, takes advantage of breakdowns in government. In fact, we saw once Ali Abdullah Saleh, the long-serving president of Yemen, a guy who'd been in power for more than 3 decades, once his regime fell apart, once the military split, it wasn't liberal groups that the U.S. would like to see take power. It was al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula moving into these villages, administering these villages, digging wells, providing sewer service, stringing electrical lines, putting teachers in school. It's al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula that's taking advantage of this. And in fact, that's what we see in a lot of places, is when long-standing dictators, brutal tyrants, collapse. It's the organizations that have lived in the shadows, that have figured out how to survive, that have some sort of organizational structure, who are willing to step into that vacuum and fill the breach and take advantage of that. As far as Yemen being a viable country, this is a question that the Yemenis themselves are debating. There's right now a national dialogue that's going on because Yemen is a mess. I mean, let's be honest. There's a rebel group up in the north that controls an autonomous zone. There's the central government, which has less power now than ever before. The military's still divided. The government doesn't have a lot of money. There's a group in the south that wants to secede. There's Al-Qaeda running all over the country. So it looks a mess, and in fact, it is a mess. And you can see, when you look at it from a U.S. government perspective, that Yemen, the country, just seems too hard to do, seems impossible to fix. This is something that the Yemenis are wrestling right now at a big conference that's taking place as we speak in Sana'a, and they're trying to find a way to make sure that their country continues to succeed and continues to be a viable place. But I will say this, if Yemen breaks down further, if we start to see what I would call a little bit of regional drift, that is areas slipping beyond the reach of the central government, the groups that are going to step in to fill the void are going to be groups like Al-Qaeda, which means that Al-Qaeda will have more territory. And what we saw in Afghanistan in the late 1990s is that when you give Al-Qaeda territory and space and time, some deadly things tend to emerge out of that mix.
Okay, this goes back to Saudi Arabia. What's the relationship between Saudi Arabia, forget it for a moment about Al-Qaeda, but what's the relationship between the current government in Saudi Arabia and the current government in Sana'a? And how do the Saudis see, going back to your last answer, how do the Saudis see they can protect themselves from Al-Qaeda in the future should the Yemen really become a failed state?
Right, this is a major concern for Saudi Arabia. So Saudi Arabia has a relationship with Yemen a little bit like the U.S. has a relationship with Mexico. There are some parallels there. Saudi Arabia is incredibly concerned about the 26 million Yemenis who are looking for work. In fact, Saudi Arabia is building this huge wall on the border in an attempt to keep the Yemenis out. I don't know if that sounds familiar to anyone, but the wall's not working. Yeah. The other thing that Saudi Arabia tries to do is that they pour a lot of money into the country, but they don't pour money into the central government and sort of increase the role of the central government and the power. They pour it into their private proxies and their private tribal sheikhs and allies that they have in the hope that by pouring all of this money into the country, they will somehow buy loyalty. This is a problem in Yemen because usually what most Yemenis do is they'll hold out their hand for money and they'll take it from anyone who wants to give it to them. And then they'll just continue to do what it is that they were going to do in the first place. So the Saudis don't really get a very good return on their rial. And in fact, what we're seeing is that Saudi Arabia seems to be just as confused as everyone else when it comes to how to fix Yemen and what it is to do with Yemen. And so Saudi Arabia is right now hedging their bets by putting money behind a variety, you know, in much the same way that corporations here in the United States do when it comes to a presidential election. They'll give money to all sides. The Saudis are doing the same thing in the hopes that whoever emerges the winner will in somehow owe them a little bit of loyalty.
All right, this is a question about cultural differences between the United States and Yemen. There are vast differences, the question says, between the West and cultures of the Middle East. In your studies, do you see any way that the United States can become more attuned to what's going on culturally in the Yemen, and that would help us deal with these problems with Al-Qaeda, whether it's in the Yemen or elsewhere in the Middle East?
Yeah, one of the things that I've been struck by in studying Yemen is the United States has a lot of people who are very intelligent, who understand the country quite well. There are a lot of diplomats who spent time in the country in the 60s and 70s and 80s and 90s before September 11th who are able to get out in the country, who speak Arabic very well, who know the people, who have personal and enduring relationships. So it's not as if the U.S. just doesn't know anything about this country. There are a lot of people, both in the State Department, in the CIA, and in other places, but because of the way that the bureaucracies work, often someone who has a lot of experience in Yemen will be there for a while, and then they'll be moved on to a place like Syria, or they'll go out of cone or out of sector into a place in Europe. And so a lot of this institutional knowledge that the U.S. has about a place like Yemen is lost over time. And as it's lost over time, what we see is these older diplomats, these older people who have been out in the field really speaking to people, getting to know the country with their eyes and their ears traveling around. As they retire, they're being replaced by younger diplomats who, of course, have less experience. But the younger diplomats aren't able to really work up to speed what their predecessors had because they're limited. They can't travel around the country because now, instead of the U.S. Embassy being an open place, it's much more of a fortress America. There are real reasons for this. We saw what happened in Libya, in Benghazi. We know the attacks in Africa in 98. The U.S. Embassy was stormed in 2012, you know, in Yemen, in Cairo, in other places. So there are real concerns, but we're losing that knowledge. And at the same time that we're losing that knowledge, we're also limiting the number of academics who can go to places like Yemen by suspending a program like the Fulbright program, which was so instrumental for my own knowledge in getting to know a place like Yemen. And it's something, I mentioned this last night, and I'll mention it again because I think it's a rather good point. One of the former U.S. ambassadors to Yemen is a very sharp woman by the name of Barbara Bodine, who was ambassador when the USS Cole was attacked in 2000. She's now at Princeton, and she's someone I consider a friend. We talk about Yemen, as you would imagine, quite a bit. And one of the things that she always says, and I think this makes a lot of sense to me, is that there's a difference between risk management and risk avoidance. And the U.S. has went way too far to the side of risk avoidance. And because we've made the decisions that we've made on attempting to avoid and eliminate all risk, which is almost impossible unless you don't do anything, because we've made those decisions, now we know much less about these countries than we used to.
All right. We've got one sort of specific technical question, which is, you've named four U.S. citizens that have been killed by drones in Yemen. How many people in all, not just terrorists and not just on the hit list that the agency or the DOD has, but how many innocent civilians, et cetera, how many people in all have been killed in Yemen by U.S. drones?
Right. That's a good question, and that's a question that has been the subject of a great deal of debate. Because how it is that you count these casualties is really at the core, and not only how you count these casualties, but a lot of these drone strikes take place in very remote regions of Yemen, areas where not a lot of people go, and so it's hard to determine exactly how many people are being killed in any strike. And to make matters worse, we have a situation where the U.S. government doesn't acknowledge most of these strikes. So a car blows up in Yemen. A missile was fired at the car from someplace. Quite often, the Yemeni government, because of an agreement which we know about from places like WikiLeaks and others and retired diplomats who speak about this, Yemen has agreed to take credit as such for the attacks. So Yemen will say, no, the Yemeni Air Force carried out this attack, even though the attack happened at night, and everyone knows the Yemeni Air Force can't fly at night. So this is one of the worst-kept secrets is the drone program. And yet the problem you have is that U.S. officials don't speak about the drone program. And also, I should point out, the drones aren't the only aspect that are being used. The U.S. has used fixed-wing aircrafts in Yemen. It's also used naval ships to fire cruise missiles into Yemen. And it's used drones. So there are a variety of different streams of weapon systems that are being utilized here. And again, the U.S. doesn't say, well, last week we fired a drone here. Even when Anwar al-Awlaki was killed in September 2011, and President Obama acknowledged it that day, he spoke of it in the passive sense. He said Anwar al-Awlaki was killed, who was a great threat to U.S. national security interests. He did not say the U.S. killed Anwar al-Awlaki. And so the U.S., because of the covert nature of this program, both in the CIA and JSOC, has shied away, which makes not only determining how many strikes take place, but also makes determining how many people are actually killed a subject of great debate. So you have watchdog groups like the Bureau for Investigative Journalism in London, which tends to estimate on the high side of casualties. And then you have groups like the New America Foundation, a think tank in Washington, which tends to go on the low side. And then you have the U.S. government, which says the number of civilian casualties that have been killed over the past 3 years is in the single digits, which I think everybody realizes is demonstrably untrue.
Okay,
We're going to switch. We've only got time for two more questions. This one is a much broader question. Do you have any insights into what the Russians or the Chinese think of American use of drones and how that might impact relations with them in the future? It goes back to an earlier point that you were making. Suppose they started using drones against what they consider to be terrorists.
Right. I think this is one of the questions, again, the Obama administration and the Bush administration both claim that they've thought about this issue of precedent. And I just don't see that thinking making much of an impact on public policy. One of the great things, when we think about the earliest American leaders, whether it be Washington or Marshall or John Jay or whoever, the thing that's always struck them in my study of history is that they really looked at the problems of the day with one eye on the present and one eye on precedent. And I don't think that that's something that either the Bush administration or the Obama administration has done very well. And so now the international precedent that has been set for the use of drones is a very frightening one. If all countries did what it is that the U.S. is doing right now with drone technology, that would be a frightening world to live in. And in fact, for much of the world, that seems to be the frightening world that they're living in right now. So the U.S. has set a precedent that I think gives Russia and China and other countries that we don't necessarily trust a great deal of latitude when it comes to utilizing this new technology.
Okay, the last question is a personal one. It's about you. How did you first get interested in the Yemen? How did you get connected to it? Why did you pick Yemen?
Right. That is a good question. I mean, the short, humorous answer is bad choices. But I first studied in Cairo as an undergrad and was really taken with the Arab world. And then I spent a tour in the Peace Corps in Jordan. And then I got to Yemen, and it just felt like home. The first day I was there, an individual who turned out to be a really good friend of mine threw me a bag of green leaves, which are known as khat. He threw me a bag of khat, and he said, "Here, chew." And I did, and then I've been going back ever since. So there must be something in the leaves.
That's a terrific answer. That explains it. Next time you come up here, Gregory, you've got to bring a little bit of khat with you so we can all share in the pleasure. Now we're going to give you, I know this is something you've been waiting for. There are lots of these in New York. There are lots in Princeton, but this may be the only one, if you take it to the Yemen, that they will have. It's the Mid-Coast Forum on Foreign Relations mug. Hey, thanks.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.